morning. Welcome to Room 200. I will convene the House Education Finance Committee. I believe we have a quorum. I'm glad everybody found their way here. We will first, let's start with the minutes. Representative Pryor, have you had a chance to look?
I have. I so moved.
Great. Representative Pryor moves the minutes for March 2nd, 2023. Any questions on the minutes? Representative Green.
So on the minutes, if we could.
Representative Green, you might want to use your microphone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could edit at the very bottom of the page, Dr. Lisa Sales Adams.
Oh, thank you so much, Representative Green. With that, are there any other questions or corrections on the minutes? Seeing none, renew the motion for March 2nd minutes to be adopted as corrected. Minutes are adopted.
Aye.
Oh, sorry. You probably should vote. Boy, I'm not with it either. It's the different rooms. So, yeah. So let's try that again. All those in favor of the minutes for March 2nd as changed or corrected, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. The minutes for March 2nd are adopted correctly this time. All right, first item on our agenda is House File 1360. Vice Chair Clardy. Thank you, Vice Chair Clardy. As you get settled, welcome to your committee in a different room. And yes, please feel free to testify and get ready. Vice Chair Clardy, would you like to move House File 1360 before committee?
So moved.
Wonderful. House File 1360 is before the committee, and I see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you briefly explain your amendment?
There was a clerical error, so the right amount was not carried over. So that was the only change.
Got it. Thank you. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Clardy, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Thank you, committee. What this bill does is House File 1360, it provides increases to safe school revenue and changes allowable uses. The specific provisions include triple safe school revenue for an additional district from $36 to $108 per pupil. It provides proportional increases for intermediate school districts and adds other cooperative school districts. It equalizes the levy to address the disparities in property wealth among school districts. It also sets the minimum guaranteed funding level at $100,000, and it expands allowable use to include costs associated with cybersecurity. So school districts do not have the funding for necessary training for staff support or specialized mental health services that meet the increasing students' needs and prevent unsafe situations for students and staff. This bill will support school districts to hire more support personnel, such as counselors and social workers, nurses, and increase the safety security of the facilities. And Madam Chair, at this point I have a couple testifiers. Would you like to proceed with them, or should I introduce them?
No, that's okay. I will take care. Sorry, I was distracted by a side conversation. No, yes, we may go to your testifiers. I have first of all Peter Olson. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Peter Olson Skog, and I thank the committee for the opportunity to testify. So I serve as the superintendent for the West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, and Eagan Area School District, and I'm testifying for AMSD in support of House File 1360. Our safe schools revenue is truly essential for our schools. It funds critical roles like therapists, counselors, suicide prevention, and drug abuse prevention, and that's just to name a few, just on the people side of the equation. Unfortunately, our Safe Schools revenue has been frozen at $36 per student for 10 years plus. For our district, that would fund about two positions to meet the needs of 5,000 kids. The Minnesota Student Survey clearly indicates why that is not enough. Just in the last 3 years, we've seen a 26% increase in the percentage of students who report long-term mental health problems. And so now, more than half, almost 60% of our 11th grade females report long-term mental health problems. So now what? What happens when we don't have the people to help support them? And sadly, many of them start to hurt themselves. More than one in three of our middle school and high school females report having purposely hurt themselves. I'm talking about cutting, burning, bruising. One in five have hurt themselves more than six times in the last year alone. And then what? Many start to consider suicide. One in five have seriously considered suicide in the last year. And if you look at just the 11th grade females, half have seriously considered suicide. And then tragically, some attempt it. One in five of our 11th grade females report actually having attempted suicide, and the rates are not as high for our males, but they're still very concerning. One in six report seriously considering suicide, and one in 10 have attempted it. So how are the children? They're hurting, and they need more from us. Their needs, our children's needs, has to be prioritized. With this bill, we could fund four more positions in our district, and with our wait lists for therapists and counseling, we would fill those caseloads tomorrow. I ask the committee to support this bill. It identifies a clear need and provides the funds to meet it.
Thank you so much. With that, we'll move to your next testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Marcy Dowd, and I am the superintendent of Intermediate School District 287. 287 serves 11 member districts in the West Metro, and our enrollment is just under 900 students. For those that are not familiar with intermediate school districts, there are four in the state of Minnesota, and we provide federal setting four or specialized services, as well as educational options for students, alternative pathways, grades K through 12, and we provide special education transitional services ages 18 through 21. I am here to recommend, in recommendation of the House File 1360, Safe Schools Revenue. First, I want to acknowledge the language that specifically identifies intermediate school districts. When the word intermediate is not part of a funding bill, a part of the language, our students do not receive that direct funding to support programs. So to the authors, I want to acknowledge and thank you for including intermediates in this language. Unfortunately, school safety is in the headlines not only nationwide but locally. It hits home specifically for our district, District 287. Just over a year ago, we recently had the anniversary of a shooting and killing of a student in our district, and most recently within St. Paul Public Schools. Our schools need to be safe, and we need the resources to keep our students safe. In District 287, we talk about layers of safety, and our schools need that layered approach. You all may be familiar with the layered approach because of COVID. We had those layers of mitigation. And it's the same thing with safety. It's not one magic thing that we do in public schools. It's the layering and the approaches that we use to support a safe school. So what we do know is that at the base of that is the relationships we have, our staff have with students. And what we layer upon that is our mental health support, both internally and externally, student safety coaches, student screening, visitor check-in systems, locked doors and cameras, emergency notification systems, and robust safety planning and significant professional development for all of our staff. And due to the shooting over a year ago, we installed weapon detection systems based on the input from our students, our staff, and our families. That is one addition that we have in our layered approach. The annual cost for District 287 for 900 students for all of those safety measures is over $1.4 million. And so I've shared with you the physical and the emotional layers that we provide. There's also another layer that is impacting public schools, and that's cyber safety. The insurance for our district will be $65,000 next year for cyber. So safety has been a huge part of public schools. And what we know about brain research is when a student is not safe or they're in the fight or flight part of their brain, they are unable to move to that executive functioning and that where learning really occurs. And so I ask you, please help us with increasing funding to support our school safety. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Superintendent. Both superintendents, thank you. With that, we've got one more testifier, I believe. Go ahead. Down, state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Morstead. Excuse me. I'm the Executive Director of Finance and Operations with Osseo Area Schools, the fifth largest district of the state, serving about 21,000 students. I'm also the current Vice President of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, or MASBO. I appreciate the opportunity to speak regarding the Safe Schools revenue and its effect on both Osseo Area Schools and other school districts. Safe Schools revenue was last adjusted in 2015 by $6 per pupil. Since then, as we've seen with many categorical revenues, we've lost purchasing power year over year in each of those specific areas. Our district uses this revenue to pay for school resource officers, who are vital piece of the pie in creating a safe learning environment within our schools, along with our school management specialists, which are staff specifically hired to provide behavioral support for students and to focus on creating relationships with individual students. Our district has also added several mental health support staff using one-time federal funds that we would like to retain, as we've seen very positive results in the efforts from these staff. Currently, on an annual basis, we have to make a difficult decision to make reductions and either reduce or reallocate school management specialist positions because of the annual increases to our school resource officer contracts. And we want to retain the school resource officers first and foremost. But the value of our school management specialists are very, very important to us. So we're essentially taking budget from other areas and squeezing that so we can maintain these people. But as it stands, and as you've heard from the superintendent colleagues who spoke prior to me, it maintain is not adequate. The needs are outweighing our capabilities today. So we need a way to expand that so we can reach every student. The legislation proposed to triple Safe Schools revenue would allow Osseo Area Schools to invest in maintaining and increasing our mental health support staff to better reach students in need. Statistics have shown that when we're provided with resources to make critical connections with every student so they feel safe and they feel heard, the overall school environment becomes a much safer place for everyone. There have been previously mentions of cybersecurity. I think it's safe to say schools in Minnesota are under attack right now. We've seen, and I know of, many active cybersecurity and ransomware situations that are currently in schools across the state, and not just independent school districts, but cooperatives that are under attack. And a lot of, especially the smaller school districts, simply do not have the resources to be able to fund cybersecurity in a way where our insurance companies will pick up. We've seen bills increase by 400, 500, 600% for cybersecurity insurance. So the increase in this revenue is a vital component to help protect schools and protect that student data. Osseo Schools strongly supports this legislation to increase the Safe Schools revenue, and on behalf of all school business officials across the state of Minnesota, MASBO also strongly supports this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, members, I'll go to the table for questions or comments. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, to the bill author for bringing this forward. And to the testifiers, I have a couple of questions. I have no problem with the bill, and I think tripling the Safe Schools levy is a move in the right direction. But just a couple of things for clarification. So we just heard from the from Mr. Morstad. We're including in here cybersecurity measures. So what you're really protecting against here is, you mentioned ransomware, and not necessarily cybersecurity and cyberbullying. It's the school districts protecting against the outside attacks and protecting their own digital assets. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's.
I'm sorry.
Pardon me.
State your name for the record again. Proceed.
Okay. Again, John Morstad.
Thank you.
So cybersecurity is really an all-encompassing feature, both one of protecting data and also protecting students in a cyber environment. I guess the portion I was testifying to is much more about protecting the data, as that's where we're seeing immediate concerns, as hackers have seen value in providing that data. What ultimately they can do is take data from a school and use that in conjunction with data they can steal from other places to create false identities. Unfortunately, for a lot of students, we're seeing false identities created for kids as young as second grade, where credit cards are being opened in their names. And they have no idea that's happening. Charges are being made on those, and their credit files for their future are being destroyed. But for our, you know, we can't get too far into the detail on it, but for us, it's protecting that student data. There's a lot of private data that we hold. Both HIPAA data and just general school private data that we need to be able to protect. And some districts have the ability to do that, but it's very expensive. Like I said, we've seen, you know, districts used to have insurance rates that were, hey, it's $5,000 for your cybersecurity policy. And what did you say it was? 65,000? Ours is, I think, close to a quarter of a million. That's some pretty substantial increases in dollars just for this one little area. Thank you.
Representative Fischer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And so one improvement I might suggest, everything you said, I don't disagree with. I think maybe from a logistics point of view, I understand why it's in here. I'm not asking that we take it out, but we might look, we should look at removing that at a later date and putting it to a different funding stream. I think that it confuses the issue of security for students and what some of the safe schools, that's just one thing that I'm thinking about. I'm not trying to take the bill down or take that down. Two other quick questions, if you could just answer these. And I'm not looking for necessarily definitive solutions, but as I listened through the mental health and I listened through some of the concerns about the suicide rates and all that, and top of mind for me is student security and some of the external forces and the conflict. So just two questions that I had that you could offer some ideas on. How can this be used to give teachers more support when I think a lot of times they feel like they're not getting as much support in these very volatile situations? Being a teacher myself and knowing that administrative support can be very helpful when there's a disruptive student or when there's a disruptive event. And then the second question, and I'll let you answer it to both of these, is how can this be used in the line of moving disruptive students or disruptive situations? How do we remove those threats? And could this revenue increase help us with some ideas or programs?
Thank you, Representative Krisha. Testifiers, could you please be very brief when you answer? We still have four bills on the agenda, and we have to be done at noon, and I've got four other members signed up. So thank you, Dr. Olson-Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Briefly, all of the things that you mentioned can be utilized within the funding stream as it stands. So looking at different ways to support teachers in the classroom, that's an allowable use in the bill. Looking at different ways to support students in crisis, our focus would be to put in things that are preventative to help the students before they become a concern in the classroom, so to help them through their crisis, to help them with their therapy needs, whatever it is, so that the teachers, when they enter the classroom, and they're not a concern to the teachers. So whichever approach that you take for it, the revenue currently would allow a school district to make those decisions and to support it in that way.
Representative Christian, quick follow up.
No, I'm good.
Okay, thank you, Representative Santamaro.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Cardew, for bringing this bill. This is an important bill. This is a timely bill. I wish that we had more time today to talk about this, because I know that this is a really important measure that we need to take regarding school safety. I've had talks with my own district, Minneapolis, about this, but you know, I think it's just the start, right? I appreciated the comments about kind of the layers of support that we need to take for this issue. It's not one thing. I mean, when we think about the dangers, the threats to our schools and students, they are myriad, right? There's so much, and I can think of just in Minneapolis and St. Paul in the last 2 weeks, we've had violence that's coming from the outside. We've had violence that's coming from student to student. We've had cybersecurity attacks. So I think that this bill is a start. I think that we need to give the districts the funding that they're asking for. I do want to say that I have a few just I have some concerns or cautions, and I think it just is for continued, you know, conversation. I just wanted to make one note to something that the first testifier talked about. Thank you for bringing in the statistics kind of about what our young people are facing. You know, I do want to say that you mentioned one statistic around gender and, you know, how male students were reporting kind of less, you know, mental health concerns than female students. You know, I think that we should be cautious when we think about that, because we actually know that male students are less likely to report and are more likely to be involved in violence. And so I think we do really need to be thinking kind of about the culture that our male students are growing up in and kind of the difference between what they're reporting and like what we are seeing. And I want us to think about how the environment of a school affects, you know, student behavior. I know that I had a conversation with some folks from Minneapolis recently, and they're telling me about kind of some of the, you know, measures that they're thinking about related to guns in schools, and kind of talking about potentially some new technology that would kind of be like a metal detector, but would be a little less, I don't know, obvious, right? But you would still have to have two staff members that would be sitting at the front of the school, kind of monitoring, checking students if it goes off. And, you know, those are two people that can't be doing other things that we need within the school. So I think mostly I want to say that this is something we can do in the school building, but we have to be doing things outside of school around gun safety control and gun safety measures. It is absolutely what we need to do at the legislature this year. I know that, you know, for Minneapolis, it's on their list of legislative priorities, because we can lock down the schools as much as we want, but if guns are still in our community, then our kids are not safe. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks to Representative Clardy. This is a good bill. I think the funding is important. Safe schools are obviously very important. Quick question. I know charter schools currently are excluded from this funding, and in this bill are still excluded. Have you considered including charter schools, because those are our students as well?
Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair Yakeem. Thank you, Representative Bennett. There have been discussions around that. The current funding stream does not allow charters to be involved in this. I know that there are two other representatives working on trying to resolve that right now, one on the Democratic Party side and one on the Republican Party side. So it is something that's of concern, because, like you said, all of our children need to be safe. So it's a funding stream issue.
Representative Bennett, yes, part of that is charter schools don't have levy authority. So the first $36 in this is sheer levy authority. And then if we add it, since we're a zero levy committee, we'd be adding state aid to whatever we did. Otherwise, it would be going on to private taxpayers. Then we have to talk about equalization. So it's a little complicated, but we have been having discussions with the charter schools. It's a bigger conversation than just like, hey, let's just give them money on this. So we're working on it. Might not get done this year, but it's an ongoing conversation. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for bringing this bill forward. The testimony was sobering. And I know, you know, we do need to support our children more. You know, and I'm reading all these reports about how, you know, the percentage of our teens, our kids, are, you know, the mental health issues are increasing. And I guess I have a question about the school resource officers Because I know for some people that's really controversial. Some people think, you know, an increased, you know, police presence in the school might disproportionately affect black and brown children. So there's that. There's that one camp. And then there's the other camp that says, you know, we need to have more power in the school to take down, you know, a shooter or, you know, deal with a situation. And I guess I have two and fairly short questions, but have you worked with NAMI Minnesota on this? Because I know they're really a great resource. And then secondly, who gets to decide how the funding is used? Is it up to the school board? Thank you.
Either the superintendents, Representative Clardy.
I'm going to jump in and then they can add something if they want to. The beauty of this bill is local control, because we're trying not to do the top-down thing, but, you know, the local school board knows what the needs of the community are. So did you want to add anything?
Superintendent?
Representative Clardy is accurate. It would be a collaboration between the board and the administration to determine the needs for the school district and to develop a plan for expending the funds.
Got it. And Representative Parish-Vega, if it's just to this question, then we have to move on. Go ahead.
I want to just say that, thank you, Madam Chair, really quick. I just left, okay, working with the school, St. Paul School District's community liaisons right now. And the ask of the request specifically is for the services that this bill is providing, is connection with community and the leaders from the school, because it's taking way more. You have businesses that are being affected right outside the school that are asking for the school's help, and you have the school's help that are asking for our help, and this is a way of ensuring that help for the full community that supports the everyday student. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, Representative Clardy, final comments.
I will keep it brief. I guess most of us grew up learning about, like, Maslow, and this is definitely one that covers that as far as, like, the security and safety of, like, mental health and physical safety. So I appreciate the support on this bill, and I would the time is right.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. With that, I'll move that House File 1360 be laid over for possible inclusion in education finance bill. Next up, we have House File 1045. Welcome to your committee. Would you like to move House File 1045 before the committee?
So moved.
Thank you, members. We have 1045 before the committee, and I also see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that as well, and then briefly explain the amendment?
You bet. I'd like to move the amendment forward. The amendment gets the bill in the order that we'd like, based on some recommendations from the Department of Education. It pushes the effective date back to fiscal year 25. And also remove some requirements that would have necessitated additional staffing at MDE. So,
great. Thank you, Representative Hill. Representative Hill moves the A1 amendment for the committee. Anybody have any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The A1 amendment's adopted. Representative Hill, proceed.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Joachim. Thank you, committee members. I'm here to present House File 1045, which addresses community education adults with disability programming. These programs are designed to serve adults with physical, developmental, or cognitive disabilities by encouraging inclusion in the community and providing educational, social, and recreational opportunities to participants. House File 1045 expands funding for all school districts who want to offer programming to adults with disabilities, and the bill increases the revenues from the current maximum of about $60,000 per district to $1 per capita for each participating district. The program currently is funded through a combination of state aid and local levy, but the bill proposes to provide the new funding primarily through state aid. A couple of important points to note. Number one, funding for adults with disabilities programming has been flat since 1985 and is not available to all communities. I think it's important to just point out that in fiscal year 25, when this bill is asking for support, that'll be 40 years since this funding was put in place, and it has remained flat since that time. Secondly, community education adults with disability programs offer a variety of opportunities for people with disabilities to engage in the community with their peers, and these programs offer supportive socialization opportunities to prevent isolation and depression. Lastly, I would offer that adult with disability programs offer affordable training and safety and life skills such as fire safety, personal safety, friendship skills, cooking skills, which adults with disabilities may not be able to access in other ways. I have a couple of community experts here to testify, and I would like to turn it over to Mr. Tim Maurer, who's the Director of Community Services and Recreation with White Bear Lake Schools. Thank you, Mr. Maurer.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
All right, thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the House Education Finance Committee. My name is Tim Maurer. I'm the Director of Community Ed for White Bear Lake Area Schools, and I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Community Ed Association, as well as my community in White Bear Lake, to advocate for House File 1045, which would increase funding available for adults with disabilities programs across the state. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 states the following: the nation's proper goals regarding individuals with disabilities are to assure equality of opportunity, full participation, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency for such individuals. And no qualified individual with a disability shall, by reason such of a disability, be excluded from participation or in or be denied the benefits of the services, programs, or activities of public entity. Of course, every American should have equal access to programs and activities that will promote their successful integration into our society. If the pandemic has taught us anything, is that isolation and marginalization impacts our mental and physical health, which ultimately has a social and financial cost to our society. I believe this doesn't account for the needs of our community members with disabilities. Asking an adult with a cognitive delay to navigate programs designed for neurotypical adults fails to recognize their needs. Not only will they experience the challenge of interacting with individuals who may struggle to adapt their instruction, they will also be required to move at a pace designed for neurotypical adults. As you're all probably aware, day training programs for adults with disabilities are being reduced in favor of encouraging them to work in competitive jobs. However, adults with cognitive and development disabilities need to practice skills to be effective in the workplace. Adults with disabilities programs are not a replacement for day programs. Instead, they offer activities in a fun, supportive environment designed to meet the unique needs of adults. An important benefit of participating in this programming is the creation of a safe space where adults can practice skills for employment, such as decision-making, finishing a project, following directions, and interacting with different people. Excuse me. Skills that benefit all adults socially and in the workplace. Participating and socializing in these activities also helps to prevent isolation and depression. During COVID, the restrictions that were implemented by group homes and other institutions and organizations created a lack of socialization opportunities and created anxiety, boredom, and an increase in behaviors. Participating in these activities create a safe space where adults feel a sense of belonging and a connection to the community, which has a positive impact on their mental health. Some Minnesotans with disabilities have the good fortune of living in certain communities and have been able to provide programming specifically designed to promote their social and mental well-being. In the 80s and early 90s, the Minnesota legislature secured funding on their behalf. Unfortunately, the growth and distribution of these funds were inhibited when the legislature made the decision in the early 90s to stabilize the funding for community education programs that were receiving the funds while rejecting any further increase or expansion. This flat funding leaves 68% of communities in Minnesota without funding and results in existing programs increasing their fees, which impacts access to adults with disabilities that may be on fixed incomes. Currently, only about 65 districts receive funding to offer community ed programs to serve adults with disabilities. Programs include activities and customized trainings and needed life skills such as cooking, nutrition, safety, relationships, and then offer activities such as bowling, dances, crafts and enrichment, and more. With limited options available for families, this would allow all Minnesota districts the ability to create opportunities where individuals feel comfortable, close to home, and in familiar settings. It is our hope that with the funding provided in House File 1045, every school district will be able to provide affordable programs to serve our adults with disabilities and meet the needs that we see in our community. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much. With that, next test card, please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Tara King, and I'm speaking to you today on behalf of parents and adults with disabilities. My husband and I have raised our four kids in Stillwater, and our youngest, Gabe, who has Down syndrome, is now 17 years old, and I see his adulthood right around the corner. I, of course, am familiar with the siblings' journey, college, first jobs, traveling with friends, marriage. Gabe's journey is a little unknown right now. The only thing I do know is that it will look different. Once he graduates high school, he'll take transition classes through the school district until he's 21, and after that, we're just not sure. A friend of mine, Kristen Clementrude, has an adult daughter with developmental delays and have witnessed her struggles. I'd like to share a little bit about her journey, and you'll also find her letter included in your packet. I'd like to highlight some of what she wrote. Kristen says, "My daughter Olivia is 35 years old. She works 3 hours a day, 3 days a week at her dream job at an independent bookstore in our town. She loves this job and enjoys her coworkers, but she's often not included in any social activities with her other employees. Olivia is a delightful, compassionate, sensitive individual, and yet she spends most of her days alone. I am her mom and I am her best friend. She is completely missing out on friendship with peers. Those with disabilities will always need accommodations, but they do not stop learning, growing, and striving for full, multidimensional lives just because they have graduated high school or finished a transition program. Like everyone else, they want to participate and connect with others. They may need help to find a seat at the table, but we as a community should have their place set and welcome them. Funding like this will open a door, will open doors for adults like Livia, allowing her and them to follow their creative passions, learn new life and social skills, and most of all, help them to find their place within our community." Kristen's words are eloquent, and if you're a parent like me, they're also terrifying. There are many other parents who echo Kristen's sentiments, and I've heard too many stories from my friends who have adult children with disabilities. At age 21, they simply feel like they fall off a cliff. The wonderful supports that the kids have in high school and transition suddenly stop. And with that, their social lives also come to a screeching halt. There aren't parties, driving to meet for coffee, new friends in the workplace, all those things that we as adults take for granted and depend upon are just not available to our adult children. Having dedicated funding for community activities and programs would help bridge this gap and speak to lifelong learning, as well as helping to continue the social supports that our people need. There's an adage that says the true measure of any society can be found in how it treats its most vulnerable members. How wonderful it would be for our state to fund this bill and to say to all those living on the margins, the vulnerable ones, we see you, we know you, and we value you. Please fund this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, members will move to the table for questions or comments. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to not speak because I was trying to be official at the time, but thank you, Representative. I am such a huge supporter of this. I have two children with special needs, and also I was on Special Education Advisory Council at my district, just working really hard in terms of integration. And we've come a long way, but when we look that we haven't increased it since 1980, what is it again?
85 was when the funding came into being.
How sad is that? I mean, just to like sit with the weights of where that is and where we put our values. So I hope this year is the year that we increase it. I think we have a lot of work. The letter that was written here is beautiful. It really, I mean, it almost brings tears to my eyes. So thank you so much for this bill and looking forward to supporting it.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, final comments, Representative Hill.
Just want to thank you, Chair Joachim, for hearing the bill, committee members, for the opportunity to sit next to two wonderful human beings. And we urge your support for this important programming. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hill. With that, I move to lay over House File 1045 for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill, as amended. Thank you. Next up, we have House File 683, Representative Edison.
Oh yeah, do you guys want to come on down?
Would you like to move House File 683 before the group?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I believe it's being laid over, yes.
Yes. Okay. Representative Edison moves House File 683 before the committee with the intention of possibly laying over for the education finance bill. With that, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill increases state aid for community education by increasing the funding formula from $5.42 per capita to $7 per capita. The bill lowers the tax rate to mitigate the local property tax increases. The fiscal note for 2024 shows that $7.7 million and $4.6 in 2025. General community education revenue has remained flat since 2005, so not as bad as the last bill that we just heard, but still, I mean, it's been quite a while. Community education programs are operated by school districts intended to maximize the community's use of public schools and designed to expand involvement with community members who have skills and knowledge to share. Community education meets the needs of communities by tailoring services through a variety of programs for children, youth, adults, and seniors. Additional funding will give school districts the opportunity to provide programs offered in these areas. General community education revenue is versatile funding, which provides school districts with flexibility to address the needs within their community. In communities with large aging populations, community education programs are primary providers for older adults, senior programs. Community revenue provides the funds for these programs, such as in West St. Paul, North St. Paul, and Fridley have some pretty great programs that they've used with their general community ed revenue. And with that, Madam Chair, I will move to my testifiers.
Thank you so much. Please state your name for the record and proceed. Whoever would like to go first. I have, whoever would like to go first, either Audra Boyer or Tony Walker.
Absolutely. Audra Boyer, Mankato Public Schools. Good morning, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and members of the House Education Finance Committee. My name, as I said, is Audra Nissen Boyer, and I serve as the Director of Community Education for Mankato Area Public Schools, ISD 77. On behalf of Minnesota Community Ed Association, thank you for hearing the bill to provide additional investments in community education. This bill provides needed funding increases to the general community ed education formula. In greater Minnesota, communities rely on their school district's community education department to meet many common and unique community needs. You may already be aware that this is how communities access enriching classes and leisure and recreational programming for youth and adults both, by extending the use of their school district buildings and facilities. You may be less likely to know that this is only the start of the resources that general community education revenue and local talent are leveraged in communities to meet the unique needs of their community. My peer Tony at Morris Area Public Schools, where 28% of the current kindergarten class identifies as Hispanic, created a community education Spanish language and cultural liaison position who works directly with guardians and students, answering questions, supporting at parent-teacher conferences, and assisting with registering youth in youth programs. This is all through the use of the general community education revenue. And in Mankato, the community education department serves as the hub for volunteer involvement. Last year, connecting 454 empty nesters, senior citizens, and college students in classroom experiences, early childhood, K-12, and adult programming, thus enriching and supporting over 30,000 hours of student learning through the use of general community education revenue. The key in both is that Morris Area Public Schools, district of 7,675 residents and 1,045 students in northwestern Minnesota, and Mankato Area Public Schools, 69,713 residents and 8,097 students in south central Minnesota, and all communities of greater Minnesota in between us, benefit from the general community ed revenue to meet common and unique needs. Each of the communities of greater Minnesota will be able to continue to meet those community needs and be prepared to meet the next needs through increased access to resources, which will be brought about by the proposal of $1.58 of increase in general community ed revenue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Nessa. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Anthony Walker, Director of Community Education for District 625 St. Paul Public Schools. So thank you. On behalf of Minnesota Community Education Association, thank you for the additional investments in community education. This bill modifies language and provides significant increases for funding in our general community ed levy. So thank you for hearing this. Last year, our general community levy in St. Paul generated just a little bit over $1.6 million for St. Paul residents and community ed in our district, which has remained flat since 2005. In this proposed bill in 2004, the levy would increase the funding in St. Paul by just under $500,000, so $489,000. So we're not talking a huge amount of money for the population we serve. Since this is a start in the right direction for the funding, it's not nearly enough in St. Paul to meet all of our needs. You've heard previous testimony here of the things that are going on in our schools and our community. Community education can be the foundational support to help this. So we ask and we wonder, what would you do with some additional extra funding? For starters, in St. Paul, it provides us more opportunities and resources for programming to reach our most vulnerable and underserved youth and families. Too many times do we have to charge fees for our programs, and it creates a haves and have-nots. And that is one of my goals in St. Paul, to try to eliminate those areas and opportunities where students can't participate because they can't afford our programs. Funding would go for additional summer learning opportunities, adult education and enrichment-based programs, early childhood classes. We're currently running or trying to run some pre-K nature-based programs through community ed as well in our district. We want and need to engage our community now more than ever. In community education, this funding would go a long way to give it the access and opportunity that we need. Now is the time where we come together and we rebuild our community. And community education has been doing this work for over 50 years, and we think in St. Paul we have a long way to go, and we need your support. The current needs of our funding do not meet all of our needs. We currently work with city and county agencies, and we support each other, but the resources are tight and very limited. Providing lifelong learning opportunities for all people, ages, and backgrounds where you work in, live, and love is key and essential to our program and to our future. Increasing funding in community education gives districts across greater Minnesota the ability to engage their communities in high-quality, affordable programming for all their residents. That's each and every one of us in this room. Finally, community education has gone through a lot in the past 3 years, which we all have, during COVID. Community education programs like mine in St. Paul stepped up during COVID, ran essential child care with our adult basic education, early childhood family education, community programs, that's a youth and adult-based programs, and school-age care programs to run our essential child care for our most in need essential workers in our community. This took a lot. It took a lot of staff, a lot of programs, a lot of ability in St. Paul to run this type of programming, not knowing the needs and communities in the areas where we were in fear. One thing I'll say to this is that most of our programs rely on revenue to meet our budgets. We didn't collect any fees during this time, state shut down. So a lot of communities across the state in community education are hurting. This is a great opportunity to try to build back some of those programming and meet the needs of communities for years to come. I thank you for your support of this bill in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Members, we just passed out the fiscal note for this bill, and I'll just have, since we have it in front of us, have Ms. Bethel briefly go over it.
Good
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, the fiscal note in front of you, if you just turn to page 2, that has more of the detail provided. It provides the information on the new language state aid versus the forecast state aid, as well as the new language levy versus the original levy and those changes. And then it provides just the difference and how much the bill costs, which, as you can see on page 1 as well as the top of page 2, the bill would cost $12.394 million in the first biennium and $4.842 million in the second biennium.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. With that, members, any questions or comments at the table?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill. I love community education. I've taken fermentation classes. I've taken financial management classes before I was busy with this job and a child. I, like, one of my most favorite things to do would get the community ed booklet from Minneapolis and, like, circle all the things that I wanted to take. You know, I also say that I think community ed plays a really important role of actually supporting our K-12 learners as well. You know, I've known multiple educators who've used community ed to take Somali language classes, to be able to have a few, you know, phrases to share with their families. And I also think, you know, I just like that at a time where across the state and certainly in my district, you know, we have less school-age children, more people are coming disconnected from our school system. And I think that leads to less people really understanding the deep needs that we have. This community education program is a way to bring taxpayers into the school. I've definitely been in community education classes where adults that haven't stepped into a school building in 30 years kind of comment on, like, what our school buildings are like. And I think it helps them really understand when we go to them with a levy for capital improvement to say, yeah, this is why, right? Like, you've been into the school building, you've seen some of the conditions. And so I think anything that we can do to just have more people interact with our schools, really understand what our schools are going through, is really important. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. Yes, I've enjoyed community ed classes too, but I had not thought about that connection between the buildings and our community, so that was a very good point. Representative, anybody else? Seeing none, with that, Representative Edelson, final comments. I want to thank you too for carrying this. I've carried it in the past, and it's about time we get it done. Thank you, Representative Edelson.
Well, good. I'm glad. That's a good indicator if you've carried it in the past, since you're the boss. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just I wanted to highlight, thank you, Representative Sensenmura. I totally agree. Community education classes are so important. I remember the first parent and child class I took as a new mom. It was like a lifeline, just trying to figure out how to be a parent. You're like, you're going to let me go home from the hospital with this little human, and I have no idea what I'm doing. And then, you know, I took a Mahjong class, Chair, you know about this past fall with our community center, and it was really amazing to be able to intergenerationally sit with a bunch of community members and learn how to play a game that I still cannot tell you I know how to play. So thank you so much, and I do hope you support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. With that, I'll lay over House File 683 for possible inclusion in an education omnibus bill. Members, we're going to have a quick switch up on the calendar. We're going to move up House File 1970 first. Representative Purcell, get settled. Representative Purcell, welcome before your committee. Would you like to move House File 1970 before us for possible inclusion in the education finance bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Now we have the bill in front of us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I ask this morning for your support to increase financial resources for adult basic education programs across the state that serve our adult learners. While it's true that ABA educators provide basic skills in English language learning, services expand well beyond basic when we adequately fund these programs. You will soon hear from testifiers about some of the great programs that have developed career pathways for adult learners that are critical in our communities and for our state's economy.
My hope is that we will continue to provide resources for these opportunities and that we might also allow additional programs to provide for wage increases to our skilled and dedicated educators as well. House File 1970 does three things. Number one, it increases the overall appropriation for ABE programs, $1.7 million increase over the base. Number two, it adds an additional annual growth factor to the statewide ABE aid entitlement, one based on the increase in the general education basic formula allowance. And three, it raises the cap on the contact hours rate from $22 per hour to $30 per hour. You have a printout in your packet materials that shows the baseline level of funding for the current year, the 2022-2023 school year. And Mr. Schramm has kindly added a column that shows the uncapped as well as the capped contact hour rate. As you can see, the capped hourly rate primarily affects smaller ABE programs in Greater Minnesota. And I had not seen a fiscal note. Is that what we don't have the fiscal note just yet. We've been working at the, on that with Ms. Beckel. And perhaps before I turn it over to my testifiers, if Mr. Schramm could walk us through the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. I was going to have him do that, but you basically did it already. Thank you. But Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, as Representative Purcell said, adult basic education is provided by consortia. So member districts are listed on this printout, but often, for example, if you look at Alexandria, there are 11 other school districts that are partners in the Alexandria program. And as you look down the list, you'll see the number of public school consortium members. There are also non-public and non-profit organizations that are parts of the adult basic consortium as well. The way the funding works for this program is that a capped state entitlement is set in statute. The number that's in statute right now refers to many years ago and is set at $44 million. That's grown over time so that it's a little over $50 million currently. So the rough appropriation increase of the bill that Representative Purcell brings to you will be about $1.8 million. There's a couple of different categories of funding. There's funding based on the census count, which are in the middle of the page. You can see about $10 million simply goes out on the census count within each of the consortia's member districts. For the contact hours, that's the primary place that money goes out, and you can see that the rate was $7.62 for the contact hours. And as you look up and down the list, you can see that amounted to about $34 million. And then there are smaller amounts of funding for English language students in each of the consortia and for those students over the age of 25 that have no diploma. So those are the funding characteristics that go into the formula. And as Representative Purcell mentioned, one part of the formula is the cap on the contact hours, which consortia's funding is reduced if its rate is above $22 per hour. So the two capped and uncapped count, the columns toward the beginning will let you identify which of those districts are. That contact hour rate has not been increased in many years either. So, Madam Chair, that's a quick summary of the way that the adult basic education funding formula works.
Thank you, Mr. Schramm. I think Representative Heyer has a question on the
round. Just understanding, thank you, Madam Chair, what Mr. Strom has just said. So with these, we're organized by consortiums, and is everybody, any adult in the state, somehow connected to a consortium?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, the witness can probably speak to this better than me, but nearly all of the school districts are involved in a consortia with one of these 30-some programs. There's also the Department of Corrections, for example, runs adult basic education programs as well. For each of the consortium, there's on this spreadsheet that I have an individual page for each of the members, so you can see in the Alexandria area which of the 11 school districts are, and the characteristics of all 11 school districts are run together for their ABE determination.
Thank you. With that, we'll go to the testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for your service. My name is Clarice Graybaugh, and I am an ABE teacher in Northfield. I work with adults who are seeking a high school credential or are learning the English language or need help with basic literacy in order to fully participate in society. I'm here today to ask you for a much-needed increase in funding. Minnesota ABE is nationally recognized for its outcomes. It helps remove barriers, reduce education gaps and is a critical partner in helping all Minnesotans achieve economic and social mobility. With its innovative and responsive programming, strong community partnerships, and dedicated teaching staff, ABE is in a unique position to help address some of our state's most pressing needs, helping to break cycles of poverty, increase employment, earnings, and opportunities for all Minnesotans. Our students are the frontline workers who cared for us all throughout the pandemic, working in childcare, nursing homes, meatpacking plants, retail. They are incredibly hardworking, often holding multiple jobs while raising their families and dealing with significant challenges like housing and food insecurity, incarceration, or violence in their home country. Whatever the barrier, ABE can help, as it did for Amber, a student of mine who had to leave school at the age of 17 to work full-time to support her newborn daughter as a single parent. Amber worked for a large retailer but didn't earn enough to make ends meet. She needed a promotion but lacked the high school credential that was required. So she worked hard, she came to class, and relearned the algebra she needed to pass her test. She got connected to the food shelf and other resources, and after several months was able to pass her GED, get the promotion, and increase her paycheck by 30%. Because of this, she was able to afford an apartment for the first time and a stable home for her baby. And today, Amber's planning to enroll in community college. With just these few simple interventions, Amber was able to change the course of her life and that of her baby. This is how ABE works. So today, I'm here to ask you to help continue this critical work by tying adult basic education to increases in K-12 funding, which would allow us to keep pace with rising costs while still operating within a lean budget. By raising the rate cap, which disproportionately affects greater Minnesota, and by providing funding for high school equivalency testing so that no one lacks a high school credential simply because they can't afford it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up, I think we have Tim Mayer. And then on deck, Scott Helland, and then Aaron Kutsky. Mr. Mayor, welcome back.
Mauer, sorry. That's okay. Good. Thanks for having me again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Mauer. I am the Director of Community Ed for White Bear Lake Area Schools. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Community Ed Association, and just want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1970. MCEA believes adult basic education is vital to Minnesota's future. As ABE supports adult learners and the future needs of Minnesota workforce, resources are needed. An increase in funding would allow ABE not only to sustain the current foundation of programming for adult learners, but expand and to meet the ever-changing landscape of Minnesota's economy. Every dollar provided to ABE is an investment in the future of Minnesota. By modifying the growth factor for ABE aid, increasing the maximum contact hour rate, you will provide additional resources to serve the needs of these students. ABE is the key program that community education supports and values. ABE provides an education for adult learners in employment skills that provide a starting point for initial entrance into the workforce, promotion within current employment, and re-entry into the workforce. Adult basic education provides second chances to our adult learners and supports the economic development in Minnesota. Adult learners are able to get the tools they need to move forward in their life, to be self-sufficient and participate effectively as productive workers, family members, and citizens. ABE is also essential in serving our low-income and immigrant communities. Through ABE, they have the opportunity to improve their literacy and employment skills so they can truly participate in their children's lives, the workforce, and our community. Adult basic education students can also can be our most vulnerable adults and can get lost in our systems. ABE provides the opportunity for connectedness, which impacts the lives of our adult learners and our community as a whole. By passing House File 1970, ABE will be able to expand innovative programming and develop career pathways with multiple learners. And by tying it to the funding increase, to an increase in funding that K-12 receives, this would connect ABE and K-12 needs together. This act would recognize ABE as a vital part of the education system in Minnesota in serving the needs of adults and their families. Thank you again for providing MCEA the opportunity to share with you how we value ABE, and why we support House File 1970.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Scott Helland and then Aaron Kutsky. Why don't you just both come up at the same time, and I'll make it a little easier. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. My name is Scott Helland. I'm a member of the Literacy Action Network and a coordinator in adult education. Literacy Action Network is a statewide professional organization whose mission is to develop, improve, and expand adult literacy services by coordinating public policy, advocacy, fostering statewide collaboration, facilitating professional development, and supporting quality adult basic education. This bill recognizes the professionalism and the hard work of teachers in our field of adult education. Currently, it's been since 2014 that adult education had seen a cost of living increase in funding the system besides one-time money. Adult education programs are focused on serving the needs of students to include English, GED, HISET, citizenship, certified nursing assistant, IT, career focus, paraprofessional training for schools, jobs in manufacturing and transportation. Educated adults can help their children learn better. And at Harmony, we had a mother and a father earn their GED with us a few years ago. While they were earning their GED, their son was actually failing math in seventh grade. And I'm happy to say that they both earned their GED, and their son is actually now a St. Paul police officer. So as it affects the whole family when the adults can go ahead and get their feet underneath them. The mom's also a nurse, and the dad's an iron worker. To increase ABE funding annually based on the percentage that K-12 receives will allow adult basic education to keep pace with the rising employment and technology costs that mirror those in K-12. This could help address waiting lists in Minneapolis and surrounding communities of 2 months or more. I want to thank Representative Purcell for bringing this bill. The piece that talks about the cap is there's no cost at that to the legislature. That's just adult education trying to make sure that as a statewide organization that we are statewide. And as previously was talked about, they said that it affected greater Minnesota greatly. About one-fourth of the consortium in the state are actually already under the cap, and those folks are more so in greater Minnesota. So what adult education is trying to do is just say, hey, we want to be across all of Minnesota, and we're willing to share the money with each other to make sure that happens. The third piece increases the subsidy for HSE, GED, and HISET, the two tests for adults to gain the high school equivalency, and it provides equitable access to all Minnesotans to pass the exam. It allows students to take that battery at no cost while funds for at least one attempt, and then students who need to take a retest would be responsible for those costs. I want to thank you for your support for this bill.
Thank you so much. Next up, state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Erin Gutsky, and I am the Executive Director for Think Self. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for allowing me to speak today. I'd like to tell you a little bit about our organization. Think Self is a community-based for adults who identify as deaf, deafblind, or deaf-disabled, and hard of hearing, as well as those who are late deafened. We serve the entire state of Minnesota with very small budgets. There is a need for our program to grow and expand capacity, especially in rural areas. We need to meet the needs of working adults and families and the responsibilities that they have, things that they need, not only in their everyday work, but also learning their, improving their life skills so they can bring stability to their family and their community. Our learners come from a wide range of education and geographic backgrounds. Some have never set foot in a classroom before in their life. Some have college degrees, but they need additional support to learn and continue their education. We offer a second chance at learning for people who have faced serious trauma and barriers and challenges, including war, racism, oppression, abuse, and systemic oppression and marginalization. ThinkSelf also creates job advancement opportunities for members of our community that we serve. Most of our staff self-identify as adult learners as well and receive advanced professional development and networking opportunities. Many of our past interns and staff have carried on this mission of equal access by providing, joining other roles, such as Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and at the state of Minnesota, at the different government agencies, and other sibling anti-violence agencies. In addition to that, our past learners are now teachers, showcasing exactly what happens when education is made accessible for deaf adult learners. They come to work with us after they're done with their education. So why is a deaf-specific adult education important? Why is it important? Well, as you can see, I use American Sign Language, and our learners are able to learn and experience education in their language. They may have experienced language deprivation in their lives, and we are able to help build their support system, build their skills. And for people with hearing loss, ASL is a natural language that is much easier to use than spoken language. It allows access to the community for over 1 million people in the United States who use ASL as their primary language in the workplace and home and beyond. We are a language immersion program. Deaf adults are able to develop their language skills through hands-on experience. Our program allows learners to spend time with fluent ASL users and in a language-rich environment. They can participate in social activities outside of the classroom as well. We give in-depth one-on-one instruction. People who have experienced language deprivation benefit from that intentional introduction to language, where a tutor or a teacher can give them one-on-one support and feedback to help them develop their skills. These experiences show how communication, how to communicate effectively in different social settings, build relationships with others, and express their emotions. And in summary, I'd like to say that ThinkSelf Adult Basic Education is a leader in the country, as we are the only program run for and by deaf individuals in the adult basic education field. So Minnesota is the leader in that. We are the only one in the country. So I ask for your investment in our program so that we may better serve greater Minnesota, and we can continue serving those who are looking for support and more education. So to that, we could hopefully add more remote classrooms and be able to teach more in greater Minnesota. Thanks so much for your time. I'm honored to be here today. She's saying thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, members, we didn't have any other public testifiers. I keep forgetting to say that. Maybe it's because of Friday, no other public testifiers have signed up. But I'll go to member questions and comments at the table. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this bill forward. My mom worked as an EL ABE teacher, and she was replaced by one of her students. And that just shows that this is a workforce bill. I mean, we are hearing every bill, everything we do, we need to be worried about this workforce, but making sure that we're educating adult learners so that they can pass their CDL test, so they can... we can make sure that people with disabilities are able to get jobs, so we can make sure that people are learning English to get them the jobs. This is where it's at. These are the people that we need in our workforce, and we need advancing into these like higher level jobs. So thank you for bringing a bill that both uplifts students, but also make sure that it's filling our very, very real workforce gaps. I guess my question would be, I know this is, I also, are there other areas of growth in ABE that we need to be looking at? I don't know. Maybe Mr. Helland could talk about that. I know that he does a lot of great work with ABE and literacy. But yeah, maybe Mr. Helland or Mr. Gutsky could talk about other areas of growth that we need to look into for ABE, because I really think this is the answer to a lot of our workforce shortage issues is ABE.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair, one of the key pieces of adult education is the more than basic piece. The certified nursing assistant, we just started a class with Century College this week with 11 adults that are working towards that. We've actually had currently a 100% passing rate with our students that come through, and you can take a certified nursing assistant course at any college and go ahead and be through there, but ours is elongated and slowed down and done with English intentionality and the folks that do it, some of which have taken a certified nursing assistant course before and failed, are getting through in this way because we're breaking it down and putting it at their pace. We have IT careers, we have bus drivers, commercial driver's license, and paraprofessionals is one that both the K-12 schools are starving for paraprofessionals, and we have folks who it fits their lives that, you know, many with young kids that they can both work and get into the system, but without taking the paraprofessional course, they can't access that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gordon. Wow, I haven't had coffee today. Representative Jordan, for that question. And just thank you for the work that you all do in ABE. And if anybody's never gone to an ABE graduation ceremony, I highly encourage it. You will walk away feeling that our future is safe in folks' hands and that we're really incorporating a lot of good work and making sure, like Representative Jordan said, it really is a workforce issue. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this bill forward. I fully support it. Great to hear the testimony. Someone said that, you know, this allows everyone a second chance at learning, and I think that's so important because learning does not stop when we finish high school or college. We need to be learning all the time. And I especially appreciate the testimony given by Mr. Aaron Getzke. I hadn't heard about that program before, and I know the hearing loss, you know, community, they really deserve our attention, and so it's really great to hear this, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Members, any further questions or comments? Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Purcell, on this. We talk about literacy, we talk about communication, and communication is the key to community and advancement to your highest potential. And that's what this does. And I just want to give love to the members of Northfield. I have a special place in my heart for that community. And this is the key points that helps that community build in so many different bridges. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, Representative Purcell, final comments.
I don't think I could sum it up any better than between the testifiers and my colleagues. So thank you for your support.
Thank you. And with that, we will lay over House File 1970 for possible inclusion in education language. With that, we have our final bill on the agenda up, House File 1547. We'll let folks get settled. Thank you, Representative Feist, for letting us move things around this morning. Welcome to the Education Finance Committee. Representative Pryor, would you like to move House File 1547 before the committee?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pryor moves House File 1547 before the committee with the intention of laying it over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. With that, Representative Feist, proceed.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. So this is the compensatory revenue fix bill. Input has been solicited and will continue to be solicited. This is a really complicated, important topic, and we want to make sure that we get it right. Compensatory revenue is the part of the education budget that is designated funds to help students who are underprepared to learn and not meeting academic performance standards. In the 2023-24 school year, an estimated $763 million, or 8.1% of the total statewide general education revenue, is compensatory revenue. The goal of this proposal is to get us to 100% of those students accurately counted by the formula in a post-free and reduced lunch form world. In addition, we hope this to be a better formula that really adequately identifies the students who need this extra funding in a way that is workable for schools. This bill also worked in a lot of recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. They have a lot of opinions that don't relate to the formula, and I worked all of those in that I thought were good ideas. So I am not a math person, so we have Tim Strom here to be the math person in this conversation, but I can explain the policy considerations behind what this bill does. So what we have is the Medicaid direct certification gets us to about 90% of the students that we want to reach with these dollars. And we wanted to reach that extra 10%, so we get 100% of those kids. And we chose to do that by adding to the formula extra weight for ELL students, for high mobility students, and for any free and reduced lunch forms that are collected up to 4%. The reason that we chose those metrics was because ELL and high mobility data is already collected, and so it wouldn't be a burden on the schools, and also we believe that those are good proxies for the students that we're trying to reach. We did not use, I have a big, just to give you an idea of how many things we considered, here's a spreadsheet of all of the different ways that you could go about doing this. And the different ways that different states have gone about doing this. Sorry, my visual aid. So like here are more ideas, pros, cons. So there are a lot of ways you could do this. Some of the things that we thought about and rejected was census data, which we felt would grow out of date over the course of each decade. And also it's not always indicative of the actual student population in a specific school. Another option is to allow schools to collect free and reduced lunch forms over the course of the year, which would increase the compensatory revenue, identify more students, but it would kind of suck for schools. So we were like, let's do something slightly easier for schools. And so those are just a couple of the examples of the considerations that we took into account before we made this decision. And again, this is a version before you. Input is desired. We also raised the required amount that must be spent at the site where the student is who generated those funds from 50 to 70%. Representative Bakeberg and Jody Withers and I had a really good conversation about this, so I think that is something that we're still talking about. You made a good point, which I can let you make your own points, actually, when we get to conversation. But just there's some interesting considerations there in terms of what the data shows, or data show, and also just considerations in terms of summer programming. So looking forward to that conversation. We eliminated the requirement that schools reserve a portion of the compensatory revenue for extended time programs. The OLA thought that was not really based in best practices and was kind of pointless. We also narrowed the acceptable uses, and that I look forward to having a conversation. I don't think I should be the one. Like a few of us should be like, yeah, this seems good. So I think it's an important conversation to have. But the goal in addressing the acceptable uses is to really make sure that these dollars are targeted towards the students, and I'll read it again, who are underprepared to learn and not meeting academic performance standards. So this is not intended to just be part of the larger budget. These dollars do have a purpose. One other thing that I think I skipped that we did is we changed the reporting requirements. So right now schools are required to report how these dollars directly impacted student achievement. The OLA said that that was unrealistic and impossible. And so instead, we require the schools to identify that their expenditures are aligned with best practices to addressing these students' needs. And also, we require MDE to provide resources on what are those best practices, where should they be spending those dollars. And that is the bill. So I think, like as I said, this is a really huge amount of money. It's a really important There are a lot of policy considerations and mathematical considerations, which Tim Strom will be the expert on if you have math questions. But I'm excited to have this conversation and continuing to work with all the stakeholders who are willing to talk with me, because I love talking about compensatory revenue. So with that, I will let, I know a couple of people wanted to speak. Sarah Burt lost her voice, but she's going to give me a thumbs up. So yeah.
Thank you, Representative Feist. With that, I think we'll have Mr. Strom go over the runs. I think they may have been placed in Representative Hill's bill folder. So look for, I think that was 1045. So look in there. There's a set of runs tucked in there that should be with this bill. And Mr. Strong, please walk over it for us, please.
Madam Chair, members, we're still waiting for information from the Department of Education on direct certification. There's been some hang-ups in that information coming to us. So that's a big outstanding issue still. But with that said, what I thought would be...
Sorry, Mr. Strom.
I can't hear you very well. Okay. I apologize. It's weird when you can't just say that. But yeah, anyway.
I'm so sorry, Madam Chair. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Feist, there's a printout in your folder that shows general education compensatory revenue for fiscal years 23, 24, and 25. The missing thing that we still do not have is the number for the direct certification compared to the paper forms for this past fall. We're anxious for that data and hoping we'll be able to plug that in early next week. What the printout shows that I think is most important is, as you can see, in fiscal year 23, a continuation of decline from year to year of compensatory revenue, but still totaling $481 million, or on average $515 per pupil unit. For fiscal year 24, you can see that amount jumps substantially by $290 million to $772 million. That jump is because of the inclusion for the first time that year of the medical assistance direct certification. Under current law, the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services worked together to match, and for a long time on the basis of SNAP and MFIP eligibility, and those were the direct matches, and we believe those were about 70% or so of the students, and the remaining 30% were filling out the paper forms still. In the fall of 22, which is the pupil count that's used for the fiscal year 24 revenue, the Department of Education was given federal approval to use a direct match on families that were eligible for medical assistance so long as their income also met the free and reduced lunch standards. That direct match, we believe, added about 50,000 students or thereabouts to the compensatory count, and the result of that was that $290 million increase in funding between fiscal year 23 and 24. So a major jump in funding to those years, and the basis for that, the primary reason for that, was the direct certification on medical assistance. We're expecting that when we get the data from MDE that we'll see somewhere roughly around 10% of the compensatory is now made up of paper form qualifications, with the remainder being direct match either through medical assistance or through the SNAP and MFIP matches. You can see then under the February forecast and the next couple of columns over for fiscal year 25, a relatively small drop in the current law forecast estimate for FY25 from $772 million to $766 million, and that's based primarily on the declining enrollment that's occurring statewide. That also means there's likely fewer free and reduced lunch eligible students in that year. Under Representative Feist's bill, one of the issues that's trying to be addressed is what to do without paper forms. Could the paper forms be eliminated? And there's a categories to replace essentially data that would not be collected through the direct match. And the first of those in the third to last columns is the percent paper forms. I'm hoping early next week to be able to plug in numbers there. And then the two other factors that, as Representative Feist said, are flexible but are currently in her bill are the percent homeless and highly mobile, which Oh, I've got the totals wrong in there. I'm so sorry, Madam Chair. That should be 1% on the total for percent homeless and highly mobile. And then on the percent EL should be 9% on the state totals. I had to codge those in by hand because of some data issues. But the amounts for the individual districts are in the right place for those two categories. So Madam Chair, sorry to take so long on this, but basically what's happening is direct certification is making on MA has made a huge jump in the amount of compensatory revenue. There are other changes. The bill that was passed related to the free nutrition for all, Representative Dorden's bill, is likely to have an impact, although we're not sure of what that impact is on the number of paper forms that are filled out each year. The direct match we expect would be the same, but the number of paper forms is likely to decline by some amount. So, Madam Chair, that's the nature of the printout, and as I said, the huge piece of data we're still missing is the percent of direct certification at each district.
Thank you so much, Mr. Strom, and Representative Heist.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if I could ask a question, because I feel like absolutely. If I have this question, then I can't be the only one, because I've stared at this a lot. So you said that you meant to put 9% for EL and 1% for homeless and highly mobile. And in the bill, we have up to 4% for English language learners and up to 2% for the highly mobile, because they're very well reflected in the Medicaid direct certification, and then up to 4% for forms. So why is it 9% and 1%?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, those totals are just on the printout that show the percent of the state's population that are each of those two categories.
Oh,
and because okay. of the way that information comes on the grade level enrollment forms from the department at the site, when I added those all up, I had to do that calculation by hand, and I screwed up which column I put them in. Those aren't connected to the numbers in your bill. That's just a data error on my part, not knowing the difference between a 9 and a 1. But with the pen, that's not fixed. So I apologize, Representative Feist.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Feist, for the question. Yes, and thank you also for all the work you've done on this. We knew the direct certification MA match was going to drastically improve our compensatory aid revenue formula, as you've seen, because it's a lot more accurate than the paper forms, but also knowing that it might not catch all kids and that leftover percent of 10% that might still be on paper forms, we needed to find better proxies. And you did a lot of research to try to figure out what those would look like. And I really, really appreciate that. And I think those proxies will probably get to the crux of those 10% of the paper forms. And also, just like in all other things, like in remodeling a house, when you rip down a wall, you see other things you should probably look at or fix. And really like the work that you did on, it was more streamlining the areas where the money could be spent and doing a few other tweaks. So that also came out of the OLA report. But just want to thank you for that. And I know we have some public testifiers sign up. We'll go to that before we go to member questions. Mr. Schaefer, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair Joachim, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Matt Schaefer. I'm the policy director at Ed Allies, and happy Compensatory Revenue Day to you all. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1547 and want to thank Representative Feist for her multi-year leadership and vision in working to improve the best tool we have in Minnesota to equitably resource schools serving students in poverty. Compensatory revenue is a student-centered and critical funding source for Minnesota schools. And while every public school in the state generates compensatory revenue, this funding formula is structured in a way that recognizes that a school with 75% of their students experiencing poverty has a higher degree of concentrated need and therefore is deserving of additional resources than a school with 25% of their student population experiencing poverty. Nearly all states provide additional resources to schools based on a poverty-related metric. Minnesota is in line with about half of the country with a concentration formula. States like Arizona, California, Kansas, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Ohio, and Texas all have compensatory-like concentration revenue streams. This is a significantly more equitable structure to provide additional resources based on student need than the alternative of a flat dollar amount per qualifying student. And Ally strongly supports Section 2 of the bill, which is a thoughtful proposal to identify compensatory-generating students that direct certification may not find. And as a reminder, nearly all Minnesota students who qualify for free and reduced-price meals, as well as generate that compensatory revenue, do so through direct certification. We also support the narrowing and focusing of the uses of the funds, as outlined in Section 3, keeping as much of the additional funds generated by students at the school site they attend in Section 4, and in Section 6, an effort to support work toward phasing out the inaccurate use of paper forms for the purpose of compensatory revenue. This bill does miss an opportunity to lift the cap for our highest need schools. Minnesota's compensatory cap in 126C.05 subdivision 3, paragraph B, penalizes schools for serving too many students in poverty by setting a cap on the per pupil compensatory funding a student can generate. No other state in the country with a concentration formula has a cap. Schools with populations of students at or above 80% in Minnesota as of fall 2022 are located in Beltrami County, Benton County, Big Stone County, Cass County, Dakota County, Hennepin County, Manoman County, Maurer County, Olmsted County, Ramsey County, Red Lake County, Sherburne County, Stearns County, St. Louis County, and Washington County. We can pretend that compensatory revenue is merely a way to funnel more money to Minneapolis and St. Paul schools. It is not. Children experience poverty all over the state. We can also pretend that a formula that works one way for schools between 0 and 80% poverty and then penalizes schools above that threshold makes sense. It doesn't. This is an excellent bill that will do a lot of good for kids, and considering that lifting the cap was in the House 2021 Education Omnibus, now should be the time to get it across the finish line and unlock funding for the highest need schools in Minnesota by removing the cap. Again, thank you to Representative Feist for your leadership on House File 1547. Thank you, Chair Youakim, for the opportunity to testify. Thank you all for your public service to our state.
Thank you, Mr. Shaver. And I see on deck Scott Greenquist. Please settle in, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Grunquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I would first like to thank Representative Feist. I know she has worked incredibly hard on this issue and has really worked with all of the stakeholders, and so we very much appreciate that. As you all know, compensatory funding is an extremely important funding stream for our school districts and one of the larger funding streams. As you've already heard, historically, we really relied on collecting the free and reduced price lunch forms. But now with the move towards universal meals, we obviously need to find a different formula. I know there's estimates on a statewide basis that direct certification is going to identify 90% of the eligible students and families. However, we have conducted a survey of our member districts, and several of them indicate that, substantially more, a higher percentage, will still need to be identified outside of the direct certification process. In fact, some have indicated as high as 30%, they think, would still need to be identified through the old traditional free form, and they'll be missed if we rely only on the direct certification. So with that said, we still would like to continue to work with Representative Feist, because we think we need to find some tweaks to the proposed formula in House File 1547 to ensure that no district loses compensatory funding. We know that the Department of Education is also working on a solution, and so we want to work with them and with Representative Feist as we move forward to find a solution that will work for all. And then just finally, Representative Feist mentioned this, that she's working with Representative Bakeberg, but we do also have a concern about the changing the site allocation requirement. This comes into play really when you have the large districts that have a lot of sites, and they inevitably might have a site that doesn't generate much compensatory revenue but still have students at that site with high needs. And so by giving your local school boards a little flexibility, you really are allowing them to make sure that all students who need extra support and services will receive them. So with that, I will stop, Madam Chair and members, and thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Kernquist. I'm going to quick ask a question before I go to the table. So those districts that you surveyed that are worried that 30% might not get the MA match, did they still see a large increase in compensatory aid with the MA match like we're seeing reflected on the spreadsheet?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, but I think the challenge here is what is the base year, right? So we had a base year where we had a significant drop during the pandemic when forms were not being completed. And so I think it's been hard to figure out what's what, given the environment we were in over the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Kernquist. With that, members, we'll go to questions at the table. I've got Representative Bakeberg.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Feist. We had a great conversation last week. I really appreciate your bipartisan work and really taking time to and reaching out and working with us on it. I won't rehash everything we talked about, but just kind of for the sake of the group, one of the discussion points is with the cap is, and I've heard this from a number of superintendents, where they won't have enough revenue generated to hire a full-time teacher, so there's enough to hire maybe a 0.4. So then they can't hire that full-time teacher, so then they, but the need is there because the students are there in the buildings, so they hire a full-time teacher, supplant it from the general fund. So that's some of the concern around that. So just at a very high level, and I can explain it more offline. I see a lot of connection to Rep. Vardy's bill as well that we talked about earlier, and some of the things overlap as well, especially the mental health support, and the truancy piece. So this is, Rep. Vardy's bill allows us to provide some proactive pieces and to be able to talk about what we're doing. And our testifiers, during that bill, really talked about the powerful things that are happening at the local districts and how each need at the local districts are unique. So that's that local control piece that is really, really important, because what we do in Jordan is very different than in Stillwater. And if we start mandating policies here, and I know this isn't a policy committee, it really ties the hands of our local districts. So we just have to be very careful about that. And we're moving into tier two and tier three discussions with compensatory revenue, and some of Rep. Clardy's is that tier one that everyone gets. That we talked about staff development, and if we really want to have good programming in place for our kids, that professional development piece is really important, so just making sure that is maintained. It was mentioned earlier about SROs and some of the pieces there. We added an SRO back in our district, and it's had a powerful impact on our students, because that SRO is doing, Officer Silbernagel is doing a fantastic job building relationships in proactive manners with kids. So it's really important that when we're thinking through those pieces. I think kind of bringing it all back together, and Rep. Weiss talked about, this is a huge amount of money that we're talking about. And I guess the concern that I have, and I would disagree with the OLA, to be honest, because we can measure the outcomes. We can have measures of what we're intervening, how we're intervening, to be able to see if it's working, see if this investment is working. Because if something works in Stillwater or in Northfield, like, I want to know that, so then I can implement that at my building. But if we don't measure this, if we just report this is how we use the money, we're never going to know whether or not that impacted our kids. And that's what it's about, because these students receiving the compensatory revenue are already in poverty. Education is the main pathway out of poverty, so we have to know if it's working, not just if we're spending it correctly, but is it working? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And I just want to clarify just for myself, too, when you mentioned the cap, you were talking about going from 50% to 70%, not the concentration cap of 80%. Okay. And then also just want to point out, and I probably not have only read the OLA report once or twice. I'm sure Representative Price has read it even more. But one of the reasons why the OLA mentioned that not how it was reported is one of the qualifiers for reporting was that standardized test, the MCAs, which is now in statute an opt-out, and we have some schools having students opt out to 50 to 70%. So it might not be a great indicator of whether or not the money you're sinking in is working, because the measure is where all schools are at. But Representative Pice, I see you nodding, so I'm sure you want to add.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bickberg, for the ongoing conversation and good points. As you were talking, I was looking for the OLA section on that reporting, because I do think reporting is important. I think having MDE, like having the staff to like, and the analysts, the math people, to really try to like dig into the data and understand the impact, I think is very important. What the OLA said about having the schools directly be the ones to say this is how much we spent and how, and this is how it impacted student achievement, is the test results, as Chair Yulek, you mentioned. They also said school districts use multiple funding streams, not just compensatory revenue, for their programming, making it difficult to determine whether results are tied to compensatory revenue alone. And then they also said just that the schools don't have the capacity. So they said the districts would require the time, money, and analytical skills that few school districts may be able to offer. So it was just sort of a practical challenge as well. But then they felt very strongly that if we ensure that schools can say and show that they're spending it on best practices designed to support these students, that would be a reporting that could be meaningful and feasible. But then also that MDE is a partner in that and can come back and also provide guidance on what are those best practices. So I think within the context of this bill and this formula, I think that makes sense. But I don't disagree that we do need to understand how this very large amount of money is impacting student achievement ultimately.
Thank you. Representative Baker, follow up at all?
No.
Okay, thank you. Members, I just want to say we do have a noon hard stop, and this is a work in progress still. As Representative Feist has been very collaborative, working with a lot of folks. But I do have three people on, so if you can just be brief. I've got Representative Jordan, then we'll go to Representative Spencer Mura, and then we'll go to Representative Bennett. Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist, for authoring this bill and taking this on. This has been a heroic amount of effort on your part, and you have a lot to show for it. But I have some questions for Mr. Strom, actually. I'm curious about what year we're using to forecast some of these numbers. So, for example, I'm looking at my district, which is Minneapolis. It's showing I wish the percentage of homeless and highly mobile students was what this form says it is. Unfortunately, I know it is much, much, much higher. Can you talk to me a little bit about, and that would make a difference on the bill ultimately if the percentage was actually closer to 20%, which is the current percentage, as I understand it, of homeless and highly mobile students in Minneapolis public schools. So I'm wondering if you could go through the runs in a little more detail and talk about how they were maybe put together and how we came up with some of these numbers.
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, members, the pupil unit estimates are from the February forecast, and districts submit their pupil counts for 3 years out. So 23, 24, and 25 are all district submitted. So when Minneapolis says they have 29,939 pupil units, that's a number basically that they submitted to MDE in January that got built into the forecast, and same for the following 2 years. The calculation of compensatory in revenue relies on the second prior year's enrollment. So the enrollment number, which is a different count, a fall count of 22, is used for fiscal 24, and an estimated fall count then is used for 25. So on the compensatory revenue itself, those are from the enrollment files, and that data is collected basically during the fall of the year and is finalized by December 15th. The homeless and highly mobile count that's on this spreadsheet and the percent EL are both taken from that fall 22 enrollment number. So those were only measuring through essentially the fall on the fall count of the number reported by the districts in those categories. There are other counts we use throughout the year. The EL count isn't going to change much. For a few districts, the highly mobile and homeless count is going to change throughout the year and is going to be in a very different place in the spring. I'm not sure. I've heard that Minneapolis will be over 10%. I'm not sure, where they'll be this year, but they're probably one of the few where that number differs a substantial amount from what's on the printout, and because of where the location of homeless shelters and things are, and where students' residency is assigned. So that's where those counts come from. I'm happy to go into more detail, with folks offline to save your committee time.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Jordan, quick follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom, for helping me out here. That's very helpful. And I again want to thank Representative Feist for all of her work on this. Pre-introduced price lunch forms are not a good measure of poverty, and so all the work you've done to identify this, other measures and proxies for poverty, is a lot of work. And I know you've been very dedicated to that. And this is the subject of compensatory aid is difficult. It's a problem. Making sure that schools get adequate funding is a problem, but we shouldn't let these problems get in the way of feeding children, and get in the way of schools providing services to help up with people. So thank you for doing that, and thank you for coming up with a really forward-thinking proposal here.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Spencer Murrow.
Yeah, thank you. I have two questions. Can you just talk a little bit more about the two changes that you're proposing? One around, removing things from the current uses for the compensatory revenue, and then the second of the keeping more funding at the site where it was generated. I guess I'm just kind of wondering, why did you feel those changes were made? And can you give maybe examples of the way that the policy is now without those changes? Like, how is that potentially hurting students that we are trying to support with compensatory revenue? Thank you.
Representative Pice, if you could be brief. We only have 9 minutes left, and I want to give Representative Bennett a chance.
Can we be brief about compensatory revenue? So the site question of raising that threshold is really interesting, and I have a pretty equivocal response because it feels intuitive that if we raise that threshold and spend those dollars at the generating site, that's going to help more of the children we're trying to help. But one thing that has become clear to me, thanks, Jody, is that it's not that we're saying that they'll spend it at the site on these acceptable uses, or they'll spend it on the electricity bill. Like, they still have to spend it on these acceptable uses at the other site. And so I honestly, it feels intuitive, but I'm still kind of grappling with that decision and how we want to do that. So that's an equivocal answer for you on that. I think it's a conversation that we need to keep having. And then on the uses, so the acceptable uses are 12, and they haven't been looked at in a long time. And some of them feel very broad. And Representative Bakeberg and I have been talking about like training and that funding. And I agree that that's really important funding. But I wanted, with the proposed list that goes down to 9, I tried to make it more really laser focused on those students that are supposed to be the targets of this funding. And like I said, I don't know that my list is the perfect list, but what we did is we narrowed it down to really focus on those kids and the programming, the staffing, the extra supports, the we looked at early learning and sorry, I'm just trying to find my list. Here's the new list. So we know that summer programming is a really big deal and a best practice for addressing these students' needs. Remedial instruction in reading. We talked a lot about literacy, language arts, math. So that's just really intuitively, this feels like a list that more directly meets the needs of the students. One of the ones that's listed as one of the 12 was apparently a really fatty program that was in the 90s. And we were let's spend money on that, master's something. So yeah, so some of the acceptable uses are just represent thinking from a while ago. And so, when we're taking this opportunity to update the formula, I think it's worth really thinking deeply about how we're using these dollars. And so that's the goal, is to just make it more targeted, have less just sort of generic use, and really more focused on these students.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, I think it just is worth, continued conversation. I guess I'm just looking at a few things like extended school day, extended school year that are going to be taken away, and mm-hmm. also the parent involvement in developing programming, mm-hmm. And would just want to know more about why we're taking those out of the list.
Representative Heiss.
Which line are you talking about with parent involvement?
This is maybe from our DFL briefing, so maybe it's not correct. So I don't know. Let's just chat offline.
Yeah, no, sorry.
Thank you, Representative Heiss.
Yeah, that sounds good. Like I said, I think that this is a conversation we need to have, because the goal, the ultimate high level goal, is to look at these acceptable uses and make sure that they are up to date with best practices. Because mm-hmm. Sometimes our statutes don't stay up to date. In juvenile justice, we don't. With so much more that we know about youth brain development, that's not embedded in our laws. So the goal is to just be thoughtful mm-hmm. and be precise and strategic in the acceptable uses.
Thank you, Representative. Yeah. Representative Frisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just cover for Representative Bennett, who stepped out. Just one quick thing. I'm just going to make a couple comments. It's obviously way too early to decide, whether I'd support or not, because you're in the middle of the process, and that's great. And in that process, just one thing to consider is don't give up on the measurement side so easy. I love the best practices side, but, you know, keep looking for that, because I think you may find, as Representative Bakeburn, there are ways to measure some of these programs and to keep that there. The only other thing I would offer is, and this is just my word of encouragement, there's not many compensatory experts around here, and thank you for starting to be one of those. And working with Representative Bakeburn and others, I can really tell that you're digging into this, and we don't do that enough. And the other thing that I'll offer up is work with your other colleagues, and it's okay to leave those outside voices on the outside for a while, because it's okay to look at this really inside and go to the experts, whether it's Clarity or Bakeburn or others, and that's great. So good luck.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Final comments.
Thank you. Thanks so much, committee, for a really good conversation. This bill before you reflects just a lot of conversations with a lot of people. Anybody who will talk with me about compensatory revenue, I will talk with them. Wanted to also just thank Tim Strom and Christina Parra for your expertise in developing this proposal. I think it's incredibly important, and I feel like we all do have to pick our little areas where we can become that expert within the legislature, and I'm working hard to be that person on this issue. So looking forward to, sorry, that was like more about me unnecessarily. Anyway, I'm excited to continue this conversation, and I'm excited by the progress we've made thus far and look forward to additional conversations. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. With that, we'll move House File 1547 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. And I shouldn't be saying move. I'm laying over House File 1547 for possible inclusion in the education finance bill. Members, it has been a very long week. So with that, just a reminder that we will be meeting at a regular time on Tuesday in our regular room. The schedule's posted for all of next week, and everybody have a wonderful weekend. We're adjourned.